And speaking of field guides, writer Lawrence Ross found an old guidebook recently that inspired him to take what he calls the blackest road trip ever. He drove 3,000 miles from L.A., where he lives, to Roanoke, Virginia. And along the way, he challenged himself to stop only at African-American-owned hotels, restaurants, and gas stations, and to use this 1957 field book as a guide.
I'm gonna buy my green cruise up and down the road.
Charles Monroe Kane was enchanted.
Well, first, what a cool thing to do.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where you kind of have this idea, wow, you know, I'm going to be traveling across the country anyway. So why not turn it into something a little bit special?
So one thing extraordinary you did, of course, was you did it based on a book. Of course, a book I've never heard of. What is this green book?
Originally, it was called the Negro Motorist Green Book, and it was done by a man named Victor Green, a New York City postal worker who saw that there was a need for a travel guide for African-Americans during segregation. The whole idea was that African-Americans couldn't just hit the road just like anyone else, right? Up until the 1964 Civil Rights Act, any public accommodation could say, no, we don't want African-Americans to eat at our restaurant or sleep at our hotels. And so what the guide was designed to do was to tell African-American travelers where they could actually stay, where they could actually eat, you know, where they could get gas. And it was a really helpful guide in order to expand the world for African-Americans, because travel was something that was fraught with danger, particularly when you were going through the South, but not exclusively to the South.
Well, let's go. Let's go. Let's do it. Tell me, what was the first place you visited?
The very first place I went was Hooper's gas station over in Compton, California, which was to gas up, of course, but it's one of the only African-American gas stations in Los Angeles. And if you can imagine—
You mean now, right?
Now, yes.
Wow.
Yeah, now. Yeah, if you can imagine, you know, the car, you know, capital of the world only having one black-owned gas station, it's pretty incredible.
It's amazing. So you leave Los Angeles, and I understand on your map, you head to Arizona, right?
Right. I go to Phoenix, Arizona, and one of the addresses that caught my eye was the Louis Jordan home. Now, people who understand music and everything, they know Louis Jordan is one of the pioneers in jazz and hip-hop and R&B. And so I figured, oh, okay, this is a great thing. Maybe it's the same Louis Jordan. Maybe it's somebody else, right? So I go over there, and it's a brick building kind of in the desert. It was listed in the book as a tourist home. Listeners should think of an Airbnb, you know, of 1957. Basically, what you could do is you could go to a boarding home or a private home that someone owned and rent a room, because you wouldn't be able to get a hotel. So I knock on the door, and the guy comes out, and I'm just, you know, hey, tell him what I'm doing, and I'm just trying to figure out, okay, who lives here now? And he says, oh, well, this home doesn't belong to Louis Jordan anymore. This home belongs to the Nation of Islam leader, Louis Farrakhan.
Oh, interesting.
So I was like, wow. You know, you don't think, I think it was going to be like Mabel Jones. So it was incredible to find, and I found that, you know, that history and present day kind of mix in almost all of these homes.
I got to ask you a question. You're trying to go to only black establishments to spend your money. How'd it feel?
Oh, it was absolutely phenomenal. And yet you mentioned the fact that one of the things I was trying to do was to see how much money I could spend at black-owned businesses.
Right.
And the whole point of that is to understand that black economics has always been one of the pillars of African-American civil rights movement, being able to have a business and then using that business to help build up neighborhoods.
Sure.
And one of the things that was great was to see, in particular, all these young entrepreneurs, particularly young African-American women who were entrepreneurs who were taking risks. This one young woman decided to open up a vegan restaurant in the heart of South Dallas.
Wow.
And I thought, you know, that's a mighty long odds when you're basically competing against some of the most delicious fried chicken and soul food around in South Dallas. And you could see how people were tying it back to some heritage when it came back to, you know, African-Americans pre-going to urban areas, being farmers and being closer to the land. And it just was great to just see kind of the entrepreneurial spirit, the risk-taking, and the pride that a lot of these business owners were taking. And so I felt really happy to spend my money there.
Wow, you sound so optimistic and enthusiastic about it. It reminds me of an interview we did once with Toni Morrison, you know, the great writer Toni Morrison. And she said, you know, it's not a popular view, but she's nostalgic for pre-segregation because the black barber and the black dentist and the black store were all patronized by other blacks and there was more community. And she said she misses that time.
There's always a yin-yang with African-American community. There's always a yin-yang because on the one hand, segregation forces you, because you're declared second-class citizens by the state, to be in the same neighborhood. So therefore, you have to patronize your own within those blocks, that neighborhood. But we always should remember the fact that that visceral feeling of community was imposed upon us based upon the idea that we were inferior. And so therefore, we did not deserve the rights of everyone else.
You know, it's funny. I'm picturing you going out and doing this, and you're popping up and knocking on a door. You say you felt welcomed, but I'm wondering if you felt like you were at home when you come into these barbershops and these places and these restaurants and these buildings. Did you feel at home?
Yeah. You know, I had this one experience that I just loved. There was this one experience where I popped up around 3 o'clock in Monroe, Louisiana. I walked into a barbershop pool hall, and you see a, you know, about a dozen African-American men. You can tell that these are working men. These are, you know, men who are from 50 on up. Yeah, and these are the type of men, you know, with grizzled hands, with broken knuckles, you know, from having done a lifetime worth of work. And, you know, one of the things I always joke about is that being African-American, that was my passport in, but it didn't mean I gained the respect. You know, I wasn't from Monroe.
Right.
They had never met me before. And they looked at me. They couldn't instantly go through the Rolodex of relatives and say, hey, you know, that's so-and-so's nephew or so on and so forth. And I looked at that pool hall as being a sacred space. You know, I stayed there for 15 minutes. It's as long as I wanted to stay there because I figured after that, my time may be running a little long. But, you know, it's but that's – those are type of the African-American community is a very welcoming community. A very, you know, we always joke is that we'll teach you, you know, you come up to my house, I'll tell you where everything is one time. Then after that, it's on you. You go and you get your stuff and you're family, you know. And by the time 15 minutes later, we'll have connections. We don't need Ancestry.com. We can make connections at some point in time of how we know each other and everything. We've never met in 50-something years. But that's kind of the warmth that you received. And I think that's life-affirming, particularly for African-Americans, because on a day-to-day basis, African-Americans deal with their regular, you know, normal lives, you know, just like everybody else. They go to work, they deal with their family and everything else like that. And then you deal with the social issues that come from the outside, the social issues intra-racial, the social issues that are interracial. And it's, a lot of times you don't really take the time, you know, you slow down and just enjoy what it means to be part of a community that's so warm and loving. And I think this trip was one of the was something that I would encourage everyone to do.
You know, it's funny, I not that I keep track of every word you're saying while I'm interviewing you, but I did keep track of a word that you said twice. And you used the word sacred twice in this interview.
Right.
Like, what made this sacred?
Well, I think it's sacred because African Americans in this country have always, you know, yearned for the permanence of space, this idea that I have a stake in this place. And so when we actually create something, when someone, for example, in Jackson, Mississippi, there was a restaurant called Shepherd's Cafe, then it turned into called Stevens Cafe. And when I did the research, one of the things that I found was how many people talked about the ritual of going from church and heading over for a meal afterwards to going to Stevens Cafe. That's where you build your building blocks of who and what you are. Your sense of community, the sense of who you think are, who are the people you think are important. And I think that's as important as walking into a church. I think that's just as important for a community as recognizing the humble person who may be waiting on you is just as royal as the mayor of the city, due to the fact that they're the person who cares for you. They're the people who recognize you growing up. That's what makes it sacred. You know, those are the things that, it's the relationships that makes the space a sacred.
Writer Lawrence Ross talking about the road trip, which he calls the route trip, that he took across the U.S. Charles Monroe Kane talked with him.